This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. We continue to be reminded by many headlines that we are still in a health crisis, a health pandemic. And among the headlines that we're really watching out for and monitoring today is we had Israel lowering the minimum age for boosters to 30 from 40. German Chancellor Angela Merkel coming out saying measures currently in place to curb the virus remain sufficient, even as infection numbers tied to the spread of the Delta variant are on the rise. And the number of UK workers going to the office, that's increasing. We're tracking that really closely. And then traffic on China's typically busy streets, that has shown some signs of recovery after the country quashed a resurgence in COVID cases. And there's also a study out saying India may face an unprecedented 600,000 new infections a day if the nation fails to boost the pace of shots. So that's some of the key headlines. I also want to point out that Dr. Anthony Fauci, of course, one of the voices that we've turned to increasingly, of course, over the course of the pandemic is White House COVID advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci. He had some comments on MSNBC earlier today on what a third vaccine may mean. Listen up.
So we may not have to get a variant-specific boost. We're preparing for it. We're doing clinical trials with it. But the data that we've seen right now indicate that we may be able to get a good response that covers the boosts by the original vaccine that covers the variants, excuse me, by the original vaccine that we got. I believe it's entirely conceivable that this third dose superimposed upon the two doses of Moderna and Pfizer very well may allow for a rather prolonged period of protection.
And that, of course, is Dr. Anthony Fauci, White House COVID advisor, speaking earlier on MSNBC. And what's interesting is there have been many from the medical community thinking that we might need to get a COVID booster shot every year, just like many of us get a flu shot. So that comment from Dr. Fauci and that observation could maybe change things going forward. All of this happening when we've got cases topping 212.7 million, deaths passing 4.44 million. These are global numbers. And as for the vaccine, more than 4.99 billion doses have been administered so far. All right, so a lot going on, and we know it's not a straight line when it comes to moving beyond this crisis. Back with us is Dr. Vino Pally. He's founder and CEO of My Doctor Urgent Care, also the chief COVID vaccine officer at My Doctor, with us once again on the phone in New York City. Dr. Pally, good to have you back here on Bloomberg Radio. How are you? And give us an update on the COVID cases that you are seeing currently.
Hi, Carol. Great to be with you. Yeah. Yes, I'm doing great. Definitely, COVID cases have been going up with the Delta variant. We're in New York City, so we have a very diverse population. Although we have very good vaccination numbers in New York City, we still have a certain percentage of people who are not vaccinated. So we are seeing these cases both in the ER and in the urgent care.
Is anything different from the first or second or third wave that we've seen of COVID cases as a result of the variant, the Delta variant? Is something different?
So Delta variant definitely presents a little bit different. It presents with more flu-like symptoms, cold-like symptoms. And, of course, it's highly contagious, as we know. Mm-hmm. Unlike the first two, with the Alpha variant, where you saw loss of smell and taste, you don't see as much with the Delta variant, but definitely it's a little bit different presentation, and it affects more severely in unvaccinated folks.
How do you, well, first of all, I want to ask you demographics. I know some of the things that we've seen, it's been younger individuals. I'm curious if you're seeing some of that as well. I also read something, I think it was yesterday, about pregnant women in some areas because they haven't gotten the vaccine, leading to some really serious outcomes.
Right. So we do know that, first let me talk about the pregnant folks. We do know that COVID affects pregnant people differently. They're at a higher risk for severe illness, hospitalizations, going on a ventilator, or even they're at risk for death. We know that from initial data. We also know that COVID causes preterm preterm labor and other adverse events. So vaccinating pregnant women is definitely helpful, and there is no safety issues that we have seen from the data that we have so far. So currently, CDC is recommending pregnant folks get vaccinated, and even mothers who are breastfeeding their infant should get vaccinated.
One other thing.
Let's talk about younger folks that you asked, Carol.
Yes, please.
Definitely, the hospitalizations have gone up. Infection rates have gone up in younger folks now. So I think it's a perfect timing to vaccinate children, you know, especially 12 and over, as CDC has recommended. So we need to move forward with vaccinating children as well. A lot of parents are hesitant. They wanted to look at data. Now that FDA has approved the Pfizer vaccine, I think parents should be encouraged to vaccinate their kids.
Well, and how do you see the FDA full approval of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine? How do you see that maybe really helping the situation and encouraging those who maybe decided not to get the vaccine as of yet to maybe go out and get it? Are you seeing any signs of it impacting the number of people getting that vaccine?
I think it's definitely going to persuade people. People who are hesitant, you know, as we know that 30% of unvaccinated folks in surveys have said that they would get the vaccine if FDA approves the vaccine completely, not just emergency authorization. So I think that should persuade more people to come forward. And in our own clinic, we are seeing people making more appointments to get vaccines now.
Yeah, I feel like it's and I know, I think Dr. Fauci made some comments I was reading in earlier today about expectations for the Moderna vaccine to get FDA full approval, and I think the J&J vaccine as well. Can you, with any confidence, look ahead to 6 months, 8 months or something and say it will feel a lot more normal? It does already compared to a year ago, obviously. But I just wonder what kind of visibility do you feel like you have when you look out at what we've come through, where we are today, and where we might be going?
I think we're definitely going in the right direction in adding these FDA-approved vaccines with Moderna and J&J coming out in a few months or probably end up September or October. I think it's going to boost more confidence in people getting vaccinated. I think as we increase numbers in terms of vaccination, we should be able to see less number of cases, and hopefully we'll get back to some semblance of normalcy. But at the same time, I think we shouldn't forget some of the public health measures, especially large gatherings, schools, where you should still continue to wear masks and protect yourself. And I think combining all these measures with the vaccination is definitely, I think, we're going to have a positive outlook.
We're talking with Dr. Vino Pally. He's founder and CEO at My Doctor Urgent Care, with us on the phone in New York City. Dr. Pally, you are on the front line. You're seeing COVID cases. You're seeing treatment. You're seeing the trends as they go up and they go down, depending on where we are in this health crisis. You've also gone out to communities to talk to people who are among the unvaccinated. Tell me about some of those experiences and whether or not you're able to convince people to actually get the vaccine.
Absolutely. You know, vaccine hesitancy and vaccine misinformation has been another epidemic that we're dealing with in this pandemic. So we do go out into the community, talk to folks. I know, especially in New York City, we have several African-American folks, Hispanic folks who are very hesitant to get vaccine. And we have several examples where we had to continuously go and educate them about the safety and the efficacy. So we've definitely seen positive impact of that and people coming to the clinic and making appointments and getting vaccinated. There's still a small percentage who are still on the border whether to get vaccine or not. And I hope this FDA approval and approving booster shot might help them with their confidence in getting vaccination.
I am curious about, you know, when people, is it just when they say, this is why I'm not getting it, is it because of the approval or is there something else going on in terms of their thinking and how they're coming to conclusions about the vaccine when you have those conversations?
Some people were waiting for the approval, but there is a small fraction of people that don't believe that COVID actually exists. Mm. And that's kind of sad. And I think there's so much misinformation about that on social media. That is somewhat difficult to combat. But hopefully, tide will turn over and people will see the truth and the scientific facts that we are presenting. And hopefully, they will also be converted. But I think what we need is a majority of the population to be vaccinated to get to that herd immunity. And hopefully, other countries are able to vaccinate their own people so we can prevent further mutations of this virus.
Interestingly enough, and not surprising, we've seen the debate about masks still playing out, especially among the nation's school systems, especially as schools start to, some have already reopened, especially in the South, but as they open here in the Northeast as well. South Carolina's second largest school system, they inserted itself into the center of that debate last week when it voted by a landslide to mandate face masks. So they defied the state's ban on such measures as the Delta spread continued in the South. What are you anticipating as we are fully back to schools in the fall, especially among many kids who are not yet vaccinated? Should we expect to see an uptick in cases?
Oh, Carol, I'm going to tell you, science is with us, right? Masking mm-hmm. is based on scientific facts. So definitely if schools or parents or teachers don't follow these masking mandates, or at least recommendations, we'll definitely see uptake in schools and certain communities and certain states, like the state you were mentioning. I think people need to understand vaccination alone is not going to solve the problem, especially vaccines are not approved for kids below 12 years old. So we really need to follow other public health measures, especially masking.
You know, it's interesting. I'm thinking where I was a year ago and how things were feeling. And, we were coming off the summer where things started to feel better. And then we all of a sudden came into the fall and the winter and we knew things got worse again. Are we in a different place 12 months later because of the vaccine?
I think we are, but we'll be in a better place probably next year once we get majority of people vaccinated. You're right. You're absolutely right, Carol, when you said, things were getting better, but also I think we have somewhat prematurely withdrew some of the public health measures and all this mixing of vaccinated and unvaccinated folks and the Delta variant coming in changed the entire dynamic. But I think the good news right now is two things, the FDA approval of Pfizer vaccine and the booster vaccine. So I think we will be in definitely be in a better place By next summer.
And I am curious, too, what you think about, we kicked this off earlier. We mentioned Dr. Anthony Fauci, obviously a go-to voice throughout this pandemic and talking about a third vaccine and what it may mean. And that I think we were, Dr. Pally, believing that we would be needing to get a booster perhaps every year, just like we get a flu shot, to deal with COVID specifically. And Dr. Anthony Fauci now saying maybe we don't need that. Maybe that third booster shot will do enough to boost our immunity for a longer period of time. What are the conversations that you are having among your medical peers and what you're seeing and reading? How do you think about that?
So the question is, what is booster doing? It's basically topping off the immunity that we've already gotten from two shots. So it's adding additional layer and probably, expanding it to further few more months or hopefully to a complete year. So it all depends on what this virus is going to do. Hmm. I think what conditions we're going to present to this virus. If it mutates into a different variant or more virulent, more contagious variant, of course we'll need a booster. And we might even need a mutation-specific booster. So right now, the current vaccines that we have are very effective against Delta variant. But let's say if things are not done right, with all these masking mandates, if you're not following public health measures, if not enough people are vaccinated, the virus will have chance to mutate more and become more virulent. And then, of course, we'll have to then think of additional booster. But time will tell. I don't think we can predict right now if we need a yearly vaccine or not. Hopefully, I hope that's not the case.
Right.
And hopefully we'll be done with this thing sooner. Yeah. But if not, we'll look at the data. We'll look at science and see if we'll need any more yearly shots or not.
Yeah.
The worst case scenario would be to have shots like flu, every mm-hmm. year, probably not as much needed as possible. Hopefully we can prevent that. But let's see.
Fingers crossed on that one. Hey, one last question. I think the expectation was that we were going to go through the entire Greek alphabet when it came to variants. Is that still to come? And could we still get a variant that's even worse than the Delta variant?
I think they are still looking at a couple more variants. There was Delta Plus variant we mentioned, and then the Gamma variant. But I think they are not variants of concern at this point, but they're still being looked at by scientists all over the world, and we're looking at from CDC. So I think we won't go through the entire Greek alphabet.
Right.
I hope not. But there are variants that they're looking at, but they're not as virulent or as contagious as of now.
All right. Going to leave it on that note. A deep, deep dive into the COVID headlines on this Tuesday, August 24th. Dr. Vino Pally, thank you so much. He is founder and chief executive officer of My Doctor Urgent Care on the phone from New York City. I want to mention one other headline involving COVID. The effectiveness of vaccines among frontline workers declined to 66% after the Delta variant became dominant, compared with 91% before it arose. This is according to a report from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
You are listening to Bloomberg Business League. Well, the headlines continue to come out regarding the crisis in Afghanistan. As we mentioned, we are awaiting some comments from President Biden, expected to make them from the White House at any moment. Get that update. We'll take you there live when it begins. Many aspects to this story. We know that, including how the Afghan war is turning a U.S. military startup into a unicorn. So let's get into that story. It's featured in the new issue of Business Week out later this week, online at businessweek.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal. It's also among our most read stories on the Bloomberg today. So here to tell us more is Bloomberg Businessweek technology editor Joshua Brustein. He is on the phone in New York City. Hey, Joshua, good to have you here with us. So who is this company?
Thanks, Carol. The company is called Shield.ai, and it was started by a former Navy SEAL who served in Afghanistan and elsewhere overseas, and was trying to solve a problem that was pretty specific to those deployments, which was entering buildings in contested areas. He built a type of drone, a small drone that they would send into buildings in advance that would map the space and send video to troops outside flying autonomously in buildings. And that would allow them to enter if there were no enemy combatants inside. So Shield has, as you said, has become a unicorn. It's just raised about $210 million and bought several other technology companies in an attempt to move beyond that specific application and start doing things more relevant to the types of wars America might fight in the future, specifically against enemies rivals like China and Russia.
So what are those? Because I have to say, to be fair and honest, it sounds so simple, right? And it sounds so logical, right? Yeah, let's throw drones in to kind of basically map out the space and check out the security. So where else can they take this?
Yeah, I think the idea here for Shield is that they could take the autonomous software they've been developing for this one application and apply it to other things, maybe trying to have communication between semi-autonomous fighter jets that are patrolling a coast, networks of vehicles, both small and large. It's sort of open-ended at this point, I think. And they're really just trying to look at, where the U.S. military is trying to take artificial intelligence, which is one of the big questions, for the Pentagon itself.
Yeah, I was going to say, how comfortable are they with this?
It's interesting. I think one of the aspects of having these small drones that are serving in a relatively low stakes environment, just, you know, sending video from one side of a wall to another, is that they slowly started to build up a trust within the military for using these things in bigger, more complicated, and frankly, more dangerous situations. But I think that, you know, there isn't full trust in these sort of systems within the military, just like, you know, anyone who's looking at relying on artificial intelligence is still questioning, like, is this stuff really going to work all the time when it matters?
Well, and Joshua, I wonder how much of their success right now is military contracts. Is it all of it?
Yeah, right now SHIELD only does military contracting. Interestingly, they said to me that they were interested in potential commercial applications. I think those are mostly around mapping. Mm-hmm. And also maybe working on domestic law enforcement, which is an interesting and somewhat controversial spin on pretty much on a lot of military hardware and systems that, you know, maybe police departments in the United States would want to use some of the surveillance type capabilities that they're building. Obviously, that's probably going to be a big fight in some of the cities where they would be trying to do that.
It does sound, you know, we had a conversation with the Raytheon CEO, Greg Hayes. He joined us here on Bloomberg Business Week on radio and TV. And we talked about, you know, kind of where things are going, certainly on the defense side. He talked about things about hypersonic weapons, which are super fast, but also using AI and different things when it comes to aerospace. And obviously that leads to military. Maybe it's a slow process, but it does sound like this is a company that, if they are on the cutting edge, could stand to benefit longer term.
Yeah, I think that this is the shift that a lot of smaller technology companies that have basically not been able to get any sort of foothold within the Pentagon see. If we're moving towards software systems that aren't the historic competence of the large defense contractors, then maybe there's room for new players. Especially as, you know, the U.S. military is trying to do things that it hasn't done before.
Right.
But, you know, I think it's a sort of wide open space.
No, it's interesting. And I love the stats that you include. I mean, you say that this company got about $17 million in military contracts in 2020. Sounds like a pretty decent contract. But as you say, the Pentagon's budget regularly exceeds $700 billion. So this is just a fleck of dust, right, in terms of their overall spending.
Yeah, like you're not even buying a single fighter jet for that kind of money. So it seems like a lot, but it's not much.
I'm curious, talk to me, because you write about a little bit about the background of this company too, and I think about juxtaposing that against what's been going on in Afghanistan.
Well, the company, as I said, sort of got its start in these wars that the United States has been fighting since 9/11, in both Afghanistan and Iraq. They've also been, their technology has been used in Syria. And, you know, as the United States has spent the last two decades sending people overseas to fight in these situations, they've discovered a lot of new problems and challenges. And, you know, so they just kind of built a technology that was specifically aimed at those situations, and now we're saying, you know, what else can we do with this?
Right, and the individuals who are involved in either founding or co-founding the company or senior executives in the company, I mean, these are people who and individuals who know people who are trying to get out of Afghanistan or hopefully got out by this time, other Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. I talked to a number of SHIELD employees over the last week or two, and a lot of them were spending a lot of time texting people they knew, calling people they knew, trying to get friends out. I know one of the people I talked to just sent me a text this morning saying that a family that they knew had managed to get out of the country. And I think that looms pretty large for them at the moment.
You cover this world, you cover high tech overall. I'm going to be catching up with Kathy Wood a little bit later on, who is all about disruption innovation. And I do wonder, and I've got to maybe put this question to her as well, but for something like the military that has been so entrenched in certain ways, but increasingly uber high tech, I mean, it seems like this is also an area where we'll see and continue to see a lot of innovation, a lot of disruption in terms of how we fight wars. We've already seen it. We talk about kind of how they are much more akin to playing a video game. Things have changed dramatically. But my gut says, and based on some of the reporting that you do and others, that there's still a lot more to come in terms of disruption of the military.
Yeah, I think that this is one of the big strategic priorities of the military. And there's a lot of tension that's going to come with those developments.
Mm-hmm.
People in defense circles talk about AI as the next big arms race. Mm-hmm. You know, China's trying to build things that will combat U.S. capabilities and vice versa. Also, the use of artificial intelligence raises all sorts of ethical questions that people are going to have to sort out and get comfortable with, or maybe not get comfortable with and decide not to do some of these things. So I think that we're going to be talking about and debating these issues for years to come.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. Hey, this company, okay, you said, I think, because of its latest funding round, $210 million from investors, including disruptive technology advisors. So that puts the company with a valuation of $1.25 billion. Is it also very possible that this becomes a takeout play for a military company or other?
I mean, I guess it's a possibility. Whenever you talk to a rising startup that's just raised a lot of money, you ask them that question and they tell you that it will never happen. And sometimes it happens. So I guess we'll see.
Yeah, fair enough. Hey, listen, it's a great story and certainly relevant to everything that's going on. Joshua Brustein, he's technology editor at Bloomberg Businessweek, on the phone in New York City.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hey, you are listening to Bloomberg Business Week on this Tuesday, August 24th. My co-host Tim Stenovic is off today. I'm Carol Messer in our Interactive Brokers studio. So out on the Bloomberg, a Bloomberg exclusive, the SEC will demand that the more than 250 Chinese companies trading in U.S. markets better inform investors about political and regulatory risks. So let's get a little bit more on this story. Our Ben Bain is financial regulations reporter at Bloomberg News. He covers the SEC. He joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. after sitting down for an exclusive interview with SEC Chair Gary Gensler. Hey, Ben, good to have you here with us. Tell us a little bit about that conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much. Good afternoon. Yeah, so as you said, I mean, we really learned a lot about Chair Gary Gensler's plan for dealing with an issue that's really festered here in Washington for almost two decades. Part of this goes back to a 2002 law that required companies that publicly trade in the United States in New York, essentially, to allow inspectors from Washington to look at their financial audits. And China has refused to allow access to U.S. inspectors. And this has been an issue that has now, you know, really gone through several administrations, multiple SEC chairs. And what we saw at the end of the Trump administration was really a bipartisan push in Congress, even, to kind of look at this wonky, issue about financial audits in kind of the broader scope of U.S.-China relations. And a law was passed in December that basically put the SEC in charge of making sure that Chinese companies and their audit firms are allowing American inspectors to review those work papers. The concern is really, that some of the financials may not be, what they say they are, mm-hmm. And also there's a lack of disclosure. If you think back to Luckin Coffee, I think that was kind of the example that a mm-hmm. lot of people will point to. There's a separate issue that SEC Chair Gary Gensler has really been raising over the past 5 weeks or so, and he really went into great detail with us today when we spoke with him, and that is about the structure of these Chinese firms. A lot of the Chinese companies and Hong Kong-based companies that are actually listed here in New York are not actually the operating companies that are listing shares, but rather they're shell companies, which mm-hmm. are often based in the Cayman Islands. So what the SEC chair essentially is saying is that American investors need to know a lot more about that corporate structure. There's concerns about how the financials situation really works out. How does money flow back and forth? And are people really aware that they're actually holding a share of a shell company and not actually a company that's based in mainland China or in Hong Kong?
Yeah, I mean, Right. Clarification, transparency. This law, though, or this requirement, only as powerful as the punishment given if ignored. What's the punishment if Chinese companies, and we're talking about the likes of what? Alibaba, Baidu, I mean, the big Chinese companies who could say, tough, we're not going to do it.
So and thus far, that's exactly what they've said. And it's not that the companies are themselves saying that, you know, they're not thumbing their nose. You know, they're basically saying, look, we can't do this because the government in Beijing won't let us do that. There's national security grounds are often cited as a reason for not for audit firms not allowing U.S. inspectors to look at the work papers. It's a very good point about what the consequences are. And what Congress did last December when they passed this new law, which is why this issue has kind of come to the forefront now, is they basically said that if this isn't, if inspectors are not allowed to look at these work papers to essentially review the financial audits, these companies could be delisted from U.S. stock exchanges within 3 years. When we discussed that with Chair Gensler, you know, he very much indicated to us that, you know, his agency, the SEC, is full speed ahead on what you know, Congress laid out in that time frame. So, you know, essentially, we could see over the next, let's say, 3 years, you know, some pretty significant repercussions if things don't change.
Those financial audits, that already happens for ADRs of European companies trading here in the U.S., any other foreign companies? That's automatic?
So what the SEC, and there's a quasi-governmental agency known by its acronym as the PCAOB here in Washington, which is overseen by the SEC. They essentially oversee the auditors. And over the course of, you know, almost two decades, what they've done is basically go around the world to more than four dozen countries, and they've reached agreements with these regulators that, you know, essentially the American inspectors will be able to look at these work papers. The two holdouts of note are China and Hong Kong. So when you talk about European countries, yes, there was some issues that have recently been resolved with a few of them. But for the most part, yes. I mean, in Europe, this happens. You know, companies from elsewhere in the world, American inspectors are able to take a look at these work papers. It's worth kind of knowing, too. I mean, this isn't American inspectors essentially going to a company and asking to see all of their financial records. This is one of the big accounting firms, for example, that does a financial audit. They have work papers, and the law requires that American inspectors are able to look at those work papers.
It's interesting, too, though, that he said that firms could be delisted as soon as 2024 if they fail to comply. I mean, that's a fairly large runway. Just got about 40 seconds left.
Yeah, it is a long runway in you know, in kind of calendar terms, but if you think about the size of some of these companies and the extent that these firms have investors in the US, retail investors, but also pension funds, but also very large institutional investors across Wall Street and really you know, across the country, it's not actually that long, because if one of these companies is delisted and they do have to, you know, American investors do have to pull back, that's a pretty significant process. So I think, yes, it seems like, you know, hey, 3 years, that's a long time. But in terms of actually what's involved, it's not.
You look at something like a Baidu, BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, T. Rowe. I mean, these are some of the big investors, institutional investors we know in these names. So that's a really good point. Ben Bain, great reporting. Check out Ben's exclusive. It is on the Bloomberg Terminal. He is financial regulations reporter right here at Bloomberg News.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just about 10 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. As Charlie said, we're getting a late day fade. We're definitely off our highs of the session. Speaking of highs, earlier today, Wells Fargo out saying that thanks to stellar U.S. corporate earnings, the S&P 500 should rise by another 8% through the end of the year. That percentage may be a little bit off at this point because of the fade, meaning we could end up with a maybe close to 30% jump in the benchmark for 2021. Their target, 4825. We've got the S&P at 4487 as we speak. Back with us is Managing Director and Senior Portfolio Manager over at Wells Fargo Asset Management. She's Margie Patel, $604 billion in assets under management. She's with us once again on the phone from Boston. Margie, nice to have you here. Your team at Wells Fargo coming out with a pretty bullish call on the S&P 500. How do you see the market trade?
Well, I think the market is going to continue to go up for the rest of the year because fundamentals are great. Second quarter, which we just wrapped up, was very good. No sign of margin pressure anywhere. Good signs of fundamental demand. Consumers in good shape. Business has lots of money. So that just says even though we've hit highs, there's no reason why we shouldn't continue to.
Even if the Fed pulls off the gas pedal?
Well, that's a question we should see next week at Jackson Hole, what they say. But really, they're kind of in a position that makes it difficult. On the one hand, their primary goal is to get to full employment. We're some millions off that. And on the other hand, it doesn't look like inflation is requiring them to start to remove liquidity because they say it's temporary. And here and there, there are signs it looks as if the inflation surge is coming down. So they may well talk a lot and not do anything for the rest of the year.
I mean, this is basically fundamentals, right? What you're saying is that, and we expected a bounce back after the lows that we saw a year ago and the impact of the pandemic. We expected companies to bounce back. Is there something more, though, significant that says it's not just about the pandemic bounce back at this point? It's more of a sustainable growth play.
Yes, it is, because corporations are in great shape. They have lots of liquidity on their balance sheet that they could buy back stock, raise dividends, make acquisitions. They have chosen at this point mostly to keep their powder dry, so they have a lot of flexibility. Consumer savings is also at record highs, and employment keeps improving. And so it's very difficult to see much that could go wrong, famous last words, but things look as if corporations should continue to raise earnings and consumers should continue to have the wherewithal to spend.
Is it getting, though, overheated?
I don't think so because, because the Fed has, it seems, rather permanently anchored rates near zero. So that assures that there's liquidity, trading liquidity, plenty of liquidity in the banks if they had loan demand. And so, no, I don't think it's overheated. And because corporate profits are rising, profit margins are very good, there's no reason why we shouldn't sustain these relatively high price-earnings ratios, high compared to history. But then the quality of corporate earnings are better, so that seems not overheated.
What do you mean quality of corporate earnings are better?
Well, if you look at the companies that are actually producing positive cash flow in their earnings in the whole Standard & Poor's, it's much higher than it's been at other times, market peaks, where we've had PEs peaking, particularly in the technology sector. Compared to, say, the Internet boom, where many companies had no earnings. Now, most of the companies have sustainable earnings, and earnings are growing very rapidly as one of the main sectors that's been leading the market.
All right. So you said positive creation of positive cash flow is higher, sustainable earnings and earnings growth. I mean, those are things, especially the cash flow, that you can't really kind of play around with, right?
That's right. That's what, at the end of the day, that really what counts, and then what sort of a PE multiple you want to put on that, of course, may be determined by market sentiment. But until we see a sea change in the Fed, which doesn't look very likely, I think it's more of the same.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Margie. I love talking with someone like you, and forgive me, because I've been watching markets for a long time, too. I'm not looking to age you or me or anybody, but we've seen a lot of market cycles, and I kind of smile when people say, well, you know, make it a comparison to the tech bubble, because this doesn't feel like the tech bubble. I mean, what is truly different about the run-up that we have seen in stocks? Because we know stocks can go up, stocks can go down, but it does feel like these cycles happen much more quickly, that any of the froth gets out of the market pretty quickly.
Well, I think the big difference is we really don't seem to be in a cyclical market anymore. It seems as if we're in a secular advance, because if you think back, all the business cycles we've had have been caused when the Fed slams on the brakes. They see something they don't like. They restrict liquidity. We have a recession. Interest rates go up. Then they flood the system with money again, and then we have a cyclical rebound. We don't have that. We have more secular easing of money, keeping interest rates near zero. So that really there, I don't see an economic cycle per se driven by what the Fed has done.
All right. Having said that, the other flip side of this story, and I'd be remiss, our Lisa Abramowitz writing about this so well, in terms of the gaps that are out there, that if you are in the equity market or you're in financial markets, you know, you have come out pretty well on the other side of this pandemic, or as things start to improve. But for many Americans, that's not the case. And that to me speaks to general wealth, general wellness of a society. And this is really a global society issue. That's got to be a problem at some point.
Well,
or already is, to be fair.
Yes, and there's a lot of talk about getting the Federal Reserve more involved in creating income equality.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, by their very actions, they have promoted the opposite. The near zero interest rates have allowed money to flow to those wealthy investors with lots of cash to put into the market, wealthy investors who can make investments in real estate, fine art, commodities, things like that. So ironically, you actually, by having a zero interest rate policy, exacerbated the income inequality or wealth inequality by having more flow to those who have a lot of liquid assets that they can take advantage.
The Fed, we talked about it a little bit. Again, you're not anticipating anything big out of Jackson Hole.
Just talk.
Just talk. So at this point, I mean, what is the risk to the current trading environment? It sounds like you're all in, bullish, and it jives with what we heard from the Wells Fargo team about upping the forecast for the S&P 500.
Well, I think that for the rest of the year, it looks like growth looks pretty good. And the only question might be, as we get into 2022, do we see a deceleration in growth from the actions of the Fed keeping rates at zero that have sort of distorted the capital returns? And could we see the economy slow down from, it's 4-ish% to 3%, 2%, 1.5% in 2022? And then people might say, oh, well, now we need to reevaluate the P.E. ratios. They need to come down, even though earnings look like they're moderating. So that's what I think. But that looks like that's a 22 potential issue.
All right, so pushing that some out a bit. Hey, Margie, thank you so much. Margie Patel, she's Managing Director, Senior Portfolio Manager at Wells Fargo Asset Management, $604 billion in assets under management, joining us once again on the phone from Boston.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.